It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're here with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the movement of millennials to urban areas is an ongoing problem for many of Wisconsin's smaller communities, but some towns are actually gaining young people. We learn about the study that looked at those areas and what they have in common.
First, it's time for our weekly check of the top national news. This afternoon, Senate leaders announced a two-year spending deal that would prevent a government shutdown on Friday. It puts more money into the defense budget and domestic programs. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking on the Senate floor today.
There are one or two final details to work out, but all the principles of the agreement are in place. The budget deal doesn't have everything Democrats want. It doesn't have everything Republicans want, but it has a great deal of what the American people want.
The Senate deal faces an uncertain future as it moves into the House. And later we'll take a look at the Democratic rebuttal to the Nunes memo that made waves last week. And the president had some choice words for Democrats over not clapping for him at the State of the Union. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the deal made in the Senate today? What do you think of the ongoing political fight over the Russia investigation? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org.
Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he covers, among other things, Paul Ryan and House Republicans. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back with you guys.
Well, we were on this verge of another government shutdown potentially, Scott. Now we've got this deal in the Senate. Broad strokes, what is in this Senate agreement?
Right. So this sets spending levels for the next two fiscal years. It basically busts the 2011 Budget Control Act caps and boosts spending for both the Pentagon and domestic programs by about $300 billion above current levels. So it intends to provide a little bit more certainty for federal agencies, most importantly for the Pentagon. A couple other highlights: it would raise the debt ceiling for 1 year all the way to March 2019. That would be well past the 2018 midterm elections. And it provides billions of extra funding for disaster aid, for the opioid epidemic, for a number of other health care programs. So there's a lot of spending in here. And that's causing a little bit of consternation for the fiscal budget hawks.
If this passed, it sounds like this would mean we wouldn't have these monthly or even biweekly budget debates and shutdown threats. But if, how big is the if here, Scott?
Well, that's the question right now, is if they can cobble together the votes first in the Senate, where this deal was struck, and then across the Capitol in the House, where right now House conservatives and the fiscal hawks that I was talking about are balking at this plan. They're really in revolt coming out of a meeting with the Speaker of the House earlier today. They just don't like all the spending, particularly the raising of the debt ceiling without equal offset. And so that leaves the ball really in Nancy Pelosi's court, and that's what they're sort of negotiating right now. Pelosi has not signed off on the agreement. She still has a number of priorities that she wants addressed. And if Paul Ryan can't get enough Republican votes, then he will have to sort of go hat in hand to Nancy Pelosi and see if she can supply some of the additional votes to get this across the finish line in the House.
And Nancy Pelosi with a multi-hour, I don't know if you call it a filibuster if it's in the House and not the Senate, but a long speech on the floor anyway. And she is holding out, it sounds like, for a commitment from Paul Ryan, similar to what Mitch McConnell gave Democrats, saying, if you want our votes on this, you got to promise us a vote on DACA, the protections for people who were brought over illegally as minors to the United States. Is that what she's aiming for here?
That's right. Speaker Ryan has already said that Republicans will at some point move forward with a vote to protect these so-called Dreamers, these young undocumented immigrants or DACA recipients. But Nancy Pelosi wants a firmer commitment, just like what Chuck Schumer got in the Senate. Mitch McConnell has basically said next week there will be a rigorous debate on immigration, on border security, but also focusing on these Dreamers, and at some point they will have more of an open process to see which immigration deal that senators can rally around. Paul Ryan is not so interested in a very open process that he wouldn't necessarily know what the outcome would be in the House of Representatives. He wants to control what legislation comes to the floor, and so he is less inclined to give Nancy Pelosi that same commitment. And that's sort of where we're at loggerheads right now over the immigration issue. That's why Nancy Pelosi has not yet signed on to this broader two-year spending caps deal. But in principle, it seems like the four leaders, both in the House and the Senate, agree on the numbers and on the priorities. It really is the issue holding everything up really is about these Dreamers and the immigration issue.
And President Trump weighed in earlier this week. He says we need stronger border security as part of any deal he would approve. Here he is talking this week about wanting to see a shutdown if that wasn't the case.
If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown, and it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown if we don't get this stuff taken care of. So we have to strengthen our borders, not by a little bit, but by a lot.
So the president taking a pro-shutdown stance there, it sounds like. Is that is the sense you're getting in Congress that, hey, no, we don't want a shutdown on either side of the aisle?
Yeah, that wasn't necessarily the message that Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan wanted to send to the country. After we already experienced a very short 3-day shutdown last month. And so, of course, the President of the United States always throws a curveball into these negotiations, and I guess that's sort of expected these days. But that was not a welcome comment up here on Capitol Hill, and I think both parties would agree that nobody wants a repeat of last month to shut down the government. Now, just to remind folks, funding expires at the end of Thursday at the stroke of midnight heading into early Friday morning. And so Democrats realizing, you know, we probably will need to have a series of votes on a bill to avert a shutdown, had to actually cancel their annual issues retreat, which was across the Eastern Shore, about 90 minutes from D.C. They actually are now huddling in the Capitol and holding their retreat here in the Capitol just because time is of the essence.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill about the latest in national news. We'll keep watching what goes on with this negotiation. But let's turn to now the latest on the Nunes memo on the FBI and the Russia probe. There is a Democratic response memo from the same committee, Democrats on the same committee. Where is that memo now? They can't just release it on their own volition. What's the latest?
Right. So earlier this week, the House Intelligence Committee, led by Republican Devin Nunes and Democrat Adam Schiff, voted unanimously to release the Democratic response to the earlier Nunes memo that was released. And so right now it's currently at the White House stage. The White House has 5 days to decide whether to publicly release that memo. You know, all indications are that Trump will go ahead and give the green light and release the memo, and so we will hear the Democratic response. Now, the concern from folks like Adam Schiff and other Democrats on that committee are that Trump may move to try to redact some of this 10-page memo. And Democrats really feel that that would be politically motivated in order to try to undermine the Democrats' argument. And of course, this all goes back to the Russia investigation. A lot of Democrats believe that the initial Nunes memo, the Republican memo, was designed to try to undermine the credibility of the various Russia investigations into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. And so it's a very convoluted procedure, but I expect by the end of this week we will see some version of the Adam Schiff memo. We just don't know how much of that will be redacted.
And Scott, this dueling memo story has gotten pretty salty. Are you seeing a lot of bad blood on that committee and beyond in the House?
There is an incredible amount of media attention. You know, on a daily basis, there is anywhere from, you know, 20 to 25 cameramen and reporters staking out this one committee, which is very unusual. And they're in the hallways. Any lawmakers coming in and out of the secured classified briefing room are immediately grabbed for an interview. It has been sort of a distraction. Of course, we have these much broader national issues like the government shutdown that's taking up much of the media space. But there are specific reporters and cameramen just dedicated to the Russia investigation, and especially in these recent weeks to the memo issue.
Scott Wong is with us, senior staff writer at The Hill. We're talking about the week's top political news.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the preliminary budget deals struck in the Senate today? What do you think of the president describing Democrats as treasonous for their response to his State of the Union address? And what do you think, or what do you want to see in the Democratic rebuttal to the release of the Nunes memo that we were just talking about? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We're talking to Scott Wong right now, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at the top stories of the week in national politics.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the politics at Capitol Hill right now? What do you think of the president calling Democrats out for not clapping for him at the State of the Union? Call in now with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can send a tweet to at Central Time WPR.
Scott, let's get into that, the treasonous comments, the backstory. There's the State of the Union address. Democrats maintain a stony silence through a lot of it. President Trump speaking in Ohio about his new tax plan on Monday went off script, I guess, a little bit. He said Democrats who weren't applauding were un-American, even treasonous. Here's a listen.
And you have the other side, even on positive news, really positive news like that, they were like death and un-American, un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? Can we call that treason? Why not? I mean, they certainly didn't seem to love our country very much.
What's the response been like, Scott?
Well, I think there's been condemnation, especially from the Democratic side. Tim Walz, who's running for Minnesota governor, he's a member of Congress. He served in the National Guard, in fact, retired as a sergeant major, and was the highest ranking soldier ever to serve in the military and serve in Congress. He said in a tweet in response, "I didn't serve 24 years in uniform serving this country to be called treason is simply for disagreeing with the President of the United States." I think most Democrats were quick to condemn the president's remarks, especially that word treasonous. And Jeff Flake, a Republican of Arizona, who is no friend of the president, but he is a Republican, and he has clashed with the president repeatedly throughout the campaign, and once the president once he took office, he gave a floor speech, an impassioned floor speech, condemning the president, saying that treason is not a punchline of a joke. It's a word and an idea that should be taken very seriously and not said offhand at a speech, at a rally. And he called it a vile remark and unbecoming of the president. But the White House pushed back and said the president was simply making a joke. It was a sarcastic remark and should be taken tongue in cheek.
Let's bring on a caller or two on this. Robert is with us in Dodgeville. Robert, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, what I think is that when Barack Obama took office, Mitch McConnell made a point soon after that to announce that he was going to do all he could to make sure that nothing went forward while Obama was president. In Trump's mind, that sounds like a treasonous type of issue to me. I don't think it's treasonous, but certainly a Trump would come across saying that that's a treasonous act. And then when you have Trump making the comment that let's have a shutdown, we need one, I want one, then that sounds like it could certainly be construed as a treasonous kind of comment.
Robert, thanks for the call. I want to bring in Sven in Appleton now on this. Sven, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I think trees are just a stretch a little bit. I think it's more of a kind of a joke on the part, but at the same time, you know, I think it's more of a disrespectful act that they should clap for the president on good notes. And there were a lot of people in the audience that deserve to have a hand, and Democrats just sat. I did watch the whole address and thought it went very well. And I think that the Democrats have to stop basically blockading on everything and start giving a little more respect.
Sven, thanks a lot. So our two callers there, Scott, giving two sides of the reaction, covering it pretty well, the broad range of reaction to the State of the Union, and then the president's follow-up comments this week.
Well, Democrats are under enormous pressure to oppose the president's agenda. Particularly their liberal base is incredibly fired up and will be fired up throughout the 2018 election cycle. They want Democrats in office to oppose the president at every turn, to oppose him on health care repeal and oppose him on tax reform and to oppose some of the controversial comments that he makes. And so I think that was, sort of reflected in the Democrats' actions in the State of the Union by not clapping, by sitting stone-faced. They knew the cameras were on them. And so it was sort of a silent protest of the President of the United States. I will say it's much different than the vocal protest we heard during one of Obama's speeches before this same Congress many years ago, where Joe Wilson shouted, "You lie," in a very controversial moment in the United States Capitol, and he was condemned roundly by both parties for shouting at the president. So in this case, it was a silent protest, and I think a lot of members said, you know, we're protected under the First Amendment. We can choose to be silent, and that is our freedom of speech.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at the latest in national politics. Want to move on to a couple more issues before we're done, Scott. Congress, the House in particular, passed a bill yesterday with broad bipartisan support that changes the system for reporting and responding to sexual assault and sexual harassment allegations in Congress. What changes here, Scott?
Well, it basically streamlines the process for Capitol Hill staffers, people who work on the Capitol, to report and to file complaints about sexual harassment and other types of discrimination and harassment in the workplace. It makes it optional for staffers to go through mediation and counseling. Previously, that was required, and a lot of these folks who went through sexual harassment experiences said, you know, it sort of brought back a lot of bad memories, and they didn't like that experience of being forced to go through counseling in order to file a complaint. And probably the most significant part of this new law is it requires lawmakers who reach a settlement with an accuser to personally reimburse taxpayers within 90 days if they reach a settlement. Previously, a lot of people were aghast to learn that taxpayers have been on the hook paying tens of thousands of dollars for lawmakers to settle such sexual harassment claims with, you know, members of their staff or other people who work on the Hill. So that no longer will be the case. Lawmakers will have to reimburse taxpayers in the future.
And then, Scott, you're on the Paul Ryan beat. Paul Ryan was in the news, some backlash this week over a tweet about what he saw as the benefit of the new Republican tax plan. What happened there?
Well, he's been promoting the tax plan like crazy, noting every, wage increase and every tax cut that companies have been publicizing across the country. And he got into a little bit of hot water when he promoted a tweet about a woman in Pennsylvania, a Pennsylvania secretary, who told the Associated Press that she saw a weekly increase of $1.50 a week from her from these tax reforms, and she said that was enough to buy her probably a Costco membership for the year. Paul Ryan promoted that story and was quickly faced backlash from Democrats and other critics who said basically $1.50 is not that much, and corporations are getting billions and billions of dollars in tax cuts, and you're promoting a woman who's getting $1.50. So he quickly deleted that tweet. I surmise that it wasn't Paul Ryan himself who tweeted it, but perhaps an aide to Paul Ryan, and that tweet was immediately deleted, and it seems like everyone's sort of moved on from there.
And, Scott, do you think the battle for public opinion on this tax plan is going to be a big deal in this year's elections?
Oh, certainly. We're already seeing that, and, you know, you can see that from the aggressive campaign that Ryan and other Republicans are waging right now in promoting, promoting the tax plan. You know, that was really the only major accomplishment of last year, and so that's basically what they're staking the 2018 election on, that Americans are going to see benefits from the tax plan in their weekly paychecks when they go ahead and file their tax returns in April, and they're hoping that those good feelings from those tax cuts will carry them through the November election and help them maintain the majorities in the House and the Senate.
And Scott, looking ahead, if this budget deal goes through and the debt ceiling limit isn't looming quite as close for a while, what's next for Congress? Is it going to be immigration?
Well, they certainly will have to deal with the immigration issue. Next month there is a deadline for these DACA recipients, these young undocumented immigrants that Trump has set. Now, Trump could punt that deadline down the road sometime. That's entirely possible, and we have seen Congress and Washington kick the can down the road on other big issues in the past. So that is one possibility, but it seems like there will have to be some sort of broader immigration deal dealing with border security and the DACA kids. And then, of course, the only other issue that possibly could get done during a tough election year is infrastructure. And we are going to see in the coming days President Trump really lay out in detail his plan for a big infrastructure package that he wants to present to Congress.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He joined us for a weekly look at the top stories in national news.
There's been a lot of talk in Wisconsin lately about brain drain and brain gain and whether young adults are leaving an area or moving in. The state has even launched an ad campaign to lure millennials in Chicago across the border into Wisconsin.
And while many rural towns are seeing young people leaving, the younger population in some areas is actually growing. A new project from the UW looked into a dozen of those communities to find out what they have in common and why younger people are choosing to live there.
Randy Stoker is a professor of community and environmental psychology at UW-Madison and is the principal investigator on the study. Randy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Allison Watson on the phone. She is UW Extension's Communities Extension Educator for Outagamie County and was also part of the research. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
So, Randy, let's start with you as the lead researcher. What was the genesis of this study?
In the University of Wisconsin Extension, there is a team that's devoted to thinking about youth and young adults in the state. And, you know, so many of the discussions are, all the youth are leaving. and that's the dominant narrative. And we sat around talking about this, and we started wondering, gee, are there any exceptions? And so we decided to set out and see if we could find exceptions. And, so this was an interesting project in that the first step was seeing if we could find any places at all and then to choose some to actually really look carefully at.
So with that in mind, was the process of finding these sort of smaller communities that had a stronger, young adult community easier? Or was it a little bit harder than you were expecting?
We actually found more than I expected that we would find. I mean, I was a little scared that there wouldn't be any. And we found 280 communities in the state out of 1,880. And so when we say community, we mean a municipality, so a city, a village, or a town. And 280 of them showed up using the measures that we decided to use.
Yeah, and so with those measures in mind, they're kind of spread throughout the state from when I looked at the map. Were there any concentrations or surprises with the municipalities you did find?
You know, they are spread across the state, and there are some significant holes. One of the maps you may have looked at was the one where we plotted the cities and the freeways in the state. And by and large, the communities that are gaining and maintaining young adults are by freeways and by cities, which means that the biggest challenge is up north, where there are neither in many cases.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that just a second, but I want to bring Allison into the conversation. Allison, you have an interesting trajectory, which I also want to get into, but when we talk about young people being in communities, what do young people, I guess, bring to the community? And why do you think retaining or gaining young adults has been such a concern for some of these smaller municipalities?
Well, I think that answer really depends on who you're asking. If you were to ask local elected officials, they would immediately speak to homeowners, you know, part of their property tax base. School officials might speak to the fact that young adults are most likely to be the demographic that has children that are school age that are supporting the school systems in these communities. And if you were to speak to economic development leaders, they would talk about workforce. So really, all three of those aspects, you know, jobs, employers, local governments that need a tax base to be sustained, and schools all rely on having young adults as part of their community.
And so, I mean, it feels like a pretty big, important goal for these communities to make sure that they have, I guess, the cycle going, having those homeowners, paying taxpayers, having kids in schools. You know, you're based in De Pere. Have you, in working in De Pere, what has been some of the, the initiatives that you have put in place to make De Pere more attractive to young people?
Absolutely. So I live in De Pere, and I actually work in the Appleton and Oshkosh market. So I'm a great example of a young professional, you know, living and working along an interstate. It feels like I spend my whole life on I-41. But I see efforts happening in the community for sure, you know, things like young professional programs, efforts to bring events to communities. But interestingly, those were not the features that came up on the top of the list of things that young adults we spoke to in communities necessarily mentioned.
And I guess I'll direct this to Randy right now. What are some of the features that young people actually want? There's a myth out there of what the millennial wants. It's something like, I don't know, avocado toast and maybe Segways everywhere. I'm not entirely sure what we're supposed to want. But, you know, what were they actually looking for?
Well, it's interesting in the young adults in these communities, so smaller and rural communities. One of the things they wanted are so obvious that we haven't paid any attention to them. They want really good schools.
Sure.
And really good schools don't just mean really good test scores. They mean schools that are inviting and welcoming in community spaces where people from the community feel like they can be part of it. They also are looking for appropriately affordable housing, and that means different things in different mm-hmm. places. Youngest families, smaller houses, smaller lots, larger, older families, larger houses, larger lots. The other kind of interesting thing, and I mean, this may go to the avocado toast, is that young adults really wanted to be near cities. Cities was where the professional jobs are. They are where the good shopping is. They are where the entertainment is. They don't want to live in cities. And they want cities nearby for all of the things that they want to be able to get from cities and avoid all the hassles in their lives that they don't like about cities. And that was a really interesting finding, to think about the connection between the urban and the rural.
Yeah, it sounds like there is less of a divide, that you want kind of the best of both worlds, but you want to make sure that the best is not necessarily, it doesn't fit a necessary pattern. You don't have to live in the city to be able to access it, but it sounds like access is the problem a lot of the time.
Yes, to be able to get to those places. And, you know, we talked to a number of young adults who moved from cities. You know, they had their urban experience, and then they met someone, and then they started having children, and then they wanted to get into a quieter space that felt safer, more predictable, and more like a community. It was interesting how many young adults talked about wanting to have a village to raise their children, and some of them even use that. You know, it takes a village. And that was a little surprising to me as well, to hear so many young adults speaking about the importance of a community of parents to co-raise the children.
We're talking to Randy Stoker right now. He's professor of community and environmental psychology at UW-Madison and the principal investigator of a project looking at what attracts young people to smaller communities. We're also talking to Allison Watson. She is UW Extension's Communities Extension Educator for Outagamie County and one of the researchers. Now, Allison, I want to get back to you, which is you grew up in New York and you went to college in New Jersey, and I understand that you were a little bit skeptical about moving to De Pere, Wisconsin. It's a little bit different than the New York area. What made you want to stay?
You know, it's, and I always tell people, I'm not a good example of someone who relocated here because I moved here to follow my family. So I didn't move here because, you know, I'd heard through the rumor mill that Wisconsin was the place to be. But I have found since moving here 6 years ago that it is a very manageable size, especially in the metro areas I live and work in, to really involve yourself in the community, get involved, connect with locals. And that's something that we found really shining through in, you know, the three communities where I was involved in the research and analysis. Was one of the questions we asked was, how many people would you say you know in your community? Kind of using knowing people as, you know, you recognize them, maybe you know their first name or a few things about them. Really high numbers from some of these smaller communities. You know, people really feel connected to their neighbors within their communities, which sort of goes against this idea that, you know, millennials are just glued to their smartphone and don't engage with the real world around them.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that anyone under the age of maybe 35 still has to kind of butt up against and move through. And Allison, I mean, you said that your experience was a little bit different. You followed your parents here. And you're in this interesting position of kind of embodying the people that are coming in, but also studying it. In De Pere, or I guess throughout the studies that you all have looked at, are there any things that connect these communities, or at least a pattern that you've all seen?
One thing that I noticed, and I don't think this is necessarily surprising, but I did see a trend across communities that public spaces were really important. Sometimes that meant outdoor amenities, things like having access to quality trail systems, even year-round. One thing that really came through loud and clear in Brown County was the fact that an existing asset, the Fox River Trail, which is a state trail that runs through the county, had actually just in the last year started to be plowed in the winter for year-round access. That was an existing asset that was being re-envisioned. That was really important, that year-round access to a public space. We also heard about, you know, it is Wisconsin, so indoor public spaces, the idea of third spaces, having places in your community that are not where you live, not where you work, where you can gather and meet with your peers. It might be a microbrewery, it might be a coffee shop, it might be a cafe environment. Those are really critical assets that we found across the communities, regardless of size, that people desired.
We're talking to Allison Watson right now. She is a UW Extension Communities Extension Educator for Outagamie County and was part of some research looking at what brings and retains young people to smaller communities. We're also joined by Randy Stoker. He is a professor of community and environmental sociology at UW-Madison and the principal investigator on this project.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. If you're a younger adult living outside of the state's bigger cities, what brought you to your community? What keeps you there? What would you like to see to make it a better place for you, maybe for your family? Or if you've gone the other way, if you've left a smaller town for another area, maybe a bigger city, why did you go? What might have kept you back in that smaller community? And even if you're not a young adult, what is happening in your community? Do you see the young people leaving? Do you see an effort to keep them there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We're talking to Randy Stoker and Allison Watson about a UW Extension study trying to find out why some small communities in Wisconsin have been able to keep young people from moving away.
And you can join in the conversation. Call now at 800-642-1234. Do you think your area is losing young people? What would you like to see change that? If you're a young person living in a smaller community, why did you stay there? Are things like affordable housing, entertainment, or proximity to a larger city important? To you? Are there hassles in cities that you're trying to avoid? Whatever your age, what do you think your community has to offer to young people? Let us know by giving us a call now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. And we are with this conversation, we're joined by Allison Watson. And, you know, part of your job is also finding and maybe selling a little bit of DePere to younger people. What have you found is an effective or has been effective in what you've been doing so far?
Well, actually, I used to be in a role where I did that. I used to run the program several years ago. That's okay. I just want to give credit to the person doing the job now.
Sure.
But when I was in that role, that was in a role that sought to revitalize the downtown, attract businesses to the community. We did kind of go with the stereotypical things we think millennials want. You know, we really tried to emphasize that there were niche boutiques and that especially that we had a quality food scene. And I actually found in some communities that we interviewed and conducted this research in that local food almost seemed to outweigh shopping to young people. If they had anything on their wish list for their community, they were really looking for locally owned restaurants, places that, you know, maybe offered more than the pizza and fried food of a bar. And I thought that was interesting that you choose to live in a smaller community, but you still desire the rich culinary experience you can gain in a larger city.
Well, it does sound interesting that that would be on the top of the list, given that, you know, Wisconsin has this reputation of being an agricultural city. There's been a big farm-to-table movement here, so it almost sounds a little tailor-made for, it sounds like, these young people who want, I mean, this is obviously just one part of it. Do you think some of it is maybe a branding issue? I want to ask both Allison and Randy about this. Allison, we'll start with you, and then I'll follow up with you, Randy.
Well, I will say, I think it's interesting watching the advertising campaign that you guys mentioned earlier that we're currently conducting and how it does highlight both the culinary assets. I believe there's one rap campaign on the L right now that features young people having glasses of wine and beer on a terrace overlooking Lake Monona. And it also features the trails. You know, there's one that features mountain biking. So it seems, you know, whoever designed that campaign almost, you know, had the same insights that we found from young people we talked to about what the effective brand might be that speaks to young people. And we found similarities between some of those images in that campaign that really rang true in the research we found that food and outdoor rec were really high priorities in selecting a place to live.
And Randy, part of this is also, do you think that there should be a move between saying move from Chicago to Wisconsin or move from Chicago to somewhere like DePere, something really specific?
Yeah, it's an interesting question whether people move to states. And you know, one of the reasons that we did this research the way that we did it was because everybody studies counties. They get all their statistics at the county level. And people don't really move to counties. They move to communities. And we were also surprised by how surprised the communities were when we approached them and we said, you know, you're a community that's gaining and maintaining young adults. And they went, we are. And so there's this kind of interesting narrative that's out there that everybody's losing kind of in the same way. And everybody's not losing in the same kind of way. And it might be worth some of these communities actually thinking about themselves as a community.
Sure. And let's actually go to our calls really quickly. We have Yasmin in Menominee. Yasmin, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am well. What did you have to say?
I just wanted to say here in Menominee, there was a survey going around asking if students would be more willing to stay in town if the river was cleaner and usable. And a lot of people responded by saying yes. And I have to say also some of my friends indicated that that's not the reason why they leave town. It's more of a privacy issue. It seems like there's less privacy in a smaller town like Menominee than there would be in the cities or even Eau Claire. And basically that type of stuff.
That's thank you for that call, Yasmin. It brings up an interesting kind of dynamic, which is you have this smaller community that might you might know everyone, but maybe the flip side is sometimes everyone kind of knows your business that maybe if you're young, you don't want people to be aware of. Is that something that persists that you've seen in these conversations?
Yes, it is. That kind of, on the one hand, gee, we really like it that everybody knows everybody. On the other hand, everybody knows everybody.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, the young adults seem to not mind that as much as youth do. Hmm. And, you know, there is this gap. A lot of people said, you know, this would not be a good community for single young adults. And so, yeah, that issue of privacy might be a part of an age cohort. And as people get older, it may not be as big a deal. Also, the question of the river, we found in a number of cases, young adults that actually did comment on the waterways in their community and how much access they had to those and wanting more access, but as part of this outdoor activity scene.
Right. Let's go to our calls again. We have Jerry in Rice Lake. Jerry, what do you have to say?
Hi. I'm very curious about the research. I had an interesting conversation with a young person who said they were moving from Brookfield back into Milwaukee, and she said she and her husband just suddenly realized they didn't want to mow lawn all the time. Hmm. And I just wondered if the research had any reflection on the type of housing that young people are looking for. We always think that the single-family home is the ideal, but does the research give any answer to that question?
Yeah, what are your thoughts for what Jerry had to say?
You know, one of the things that we didn't look at was young adults moving into cities. Interestingly enough, Milwaukee County is one of the biggest losers in terms of young adults. So while people are concerned about this in rural areas, it's urban areas that can suffer as well. But it wasn't a question we addressed. It's partly because that our funding was to focus on rural areas.
Sure.
And it is interesting that families at different age levels were comfortable with different size lots and different size houses. And so again, it's not about young adults, but it's about certain young adults in certain places at certain times.
And Allison, with just about a minute left, as someone who's young, who's in Wisconsin, what would you like to see happen in the state moving forward with maybe attracting families and growing these smaller communities?
You know, I don't know what the magic solution is, but I would really love to see maybe a really targeted brand, maybe losing the national identity we have that we are exclusively beer and football and highlighting, yes, we have great beer and great football, but look at all these other things we have as well.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us. And Randy, thank you so much for being in studio with us today. This has been a really fun conversation about, you know, how our smaller communities can grow and stay strong. We talked to Randy Stoker. He's a professor of community and environmental sociology at UW-Madison and the principal investigator on a project looking at brain gain and brain drain in smaller communities. We were also joined by Allison Watson. She is the UW Extension's Communities Extension Educator for Outagamie County and one of the researchers.
And you can still share your thoughts and your experiences in your community over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. What appeals to you as a young person about Wisconsin's smaller communities? You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. There's a big change in the works in the music world. Electronics chain store Best Buy is going to stop carrying CDs this summer, according to reports out this week.
And it's part of a wider trend of people streaming more and more music, with streaming becoming the top way people listen to music starting in 2016.
Yeah, this is true in my home in some ways. I still have a lot of CDs around. When's the last time I actually bought a new CD? It's been quite a while.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time I bought a CD. I definitely remember signing up for a music streaming service. I won't say the brand, but I find that I definitely am falling into that category of people who use streaming services.
Yeah, and CDs were big in my life for a long time. They were a fun novelty at one point. Now they're on the way out. You remember your first CD?
Yeah, I feel like we've actually brought this up on the show previously.
We need to keep bringing it up.
Because we really need to drive this point home. My first CD was Hanson's Middle of Nowhere, which people will hopefully remember was what brought us Mbop. I have no shame, personally. I think I actually just remember the last CD I bought to drive home how cool I am. I think it was the Lord of the Rings soundtrack.
Wow.
So, yeah, CDs.
CDs are pretty much out in your household, but you still have vinyl.
I have vinyl. That's actually what I use my stereo for mostly.
All right. I don't have any vinyl left. CDs, we'll see how long they stick around. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.